Hello, everyone. Larry Mishkin welcoming you to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm coming to you today from very, very rainy Chicago, Illinois, in a happy mood. My granddaughter, Ruby, is in town visiting, and that's always fun. We've been playing a lot of fish and a lot of dead and dancing around the living room, although she doesn't dance yet. She doesn't walk yet, but I can do it while I'm holding her or my son or any group of us, and it's clear she's taking a strong liking to it, and we wouldn't have it any other way in our household, although we're always open to other alternatives. We've got really a fun show today. We've been really lucky the last few weeks with some great interviews. We have a few more coming up in a few weeks. But today it's just me and a really, really great show to talk about from Oakland Alameda County Stadium in Oakland, California, May 27th, 1989, 35 years ago today. A significant milestone. It's called A Day on the Green. It was an AIDS benefit put on by Bill Graham and a cast of many. Tracy Chapman was there, an American singer-songwriter, known for her hit singles Fast Cars from her debut album, Tracy Chapman, in 1988, and Gimme One Reason from her fourth album, which on that day was still a few years away, New Beginnings from 1995. Some of you may know that Fast Cars enjoyed a resurgence thanks to country star Luke Combs, whose cover version went platinum in 2023, and by September that year was number one country hit, making Chapman the first black woman with a solo songwriting credit number one on the country charts. John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater Revival fame is there, and we're going to talk about his set in a few minutes. Los Lobos appeared, Joe Satriani, an American rock guitarist, composer, and songwriter. He's been all around, worked with many as a studio musician. He's gone on to have a successful solo music career starting in the mid-1980s. He's a 15-time Grammy Award nominee and has sold over 10 million albums, making him the best-selling instrumental rock guitarist of all time. Think about that. The best-selling instrumental rock guitarist of all time. In 1988, he was recruited by Mick Jagger as lead guitarist for Mick's first solo tour. Satriani briefly toured with Deep Purple, joining shortly after the departure of Ritchie Blackmore from the band in November of 93, and he's worked with a range of guitarists during the G3 tour, which he co-founded back in 1995. Tower of Power was there, and last but not least, the Grateful Dead. And the Dead come out after all of this music, and we're not going to play you the song they opened with, but we're going to play you the song that I think really got everything going. So, Dan, let's start off with Althea.
Told Althea I was a roving sailor. I was born to be a bachelor. Althea told me, okay, that's fine. You know now I'm trying to catch you. Without talking to me, we're guilty of the same old thing. Thinking a lot about less and less, and forgetting the love we bring.
Althea is always one of my all-time favorites from the Go to Heaven album. Came out in April of 1980. It's a Garcia Hunter masterpiece. Always a Jerry favorite. Loved by deadheads everywhere. This was the third song of the show following the Touch of Grey opener, of course, for that era. And a really great version of Greatest Story. But I wanted to go with the Althea because it's great guitar work, lovely vocals. This song really launches the show and gets everyone in the groove. And today, as I'm listening to Althea, I also want to give a special shout-out to my good buddy Tommy, who's always loved Althea, and we're thinking of Tommy and his whole family right now. And think of this Althea as a shout-out to you, buddy. So we will be in touch, and love you very much. So we've got Althea opening up the show. The boys played it 273 times. It was first played on August 4th, 1979, at the Oakland Civic Auditorium in Oakland, California. Last played on July 8th, 1995 at Soldier Field in Chicago. So one of those songs that made it right up to the final weekend. Now focusing back on this event where everybody was at, where the Dead were headlining, the weather for the day on the green was perfect. Bill Graham apparently had an exclusive arrangement with some greater power, so it was so that it never ever rained when he was having a major outdoor show. And his deal remained in place for the May 1989 AIDS benefit. Another oddity about the AIDS benefit was that there was no less than five opening acts for the Grateful Dead, which may have been some kind of record for a Bay Area Grateful Dead show. To see the entire event would have meant at least 12 hours in the sun, just to wipe yourself out for what most people really wanted to see at the very end anyway, which of course was the Grateful Dead. And it seems shocking today, maybe, that the benefit concert for a terrible disease would be seen as progressive political act, but such was the Reagan 1980s. At least in San Francisco, efforts to prevent AIDS and provide care for those suffering from it had finally expanded beyond the gay community into the general culture. Nonetheless, it was still significant when major rock bands headlined a large benefit concert in the Bay Area's biggest venue. Concern for AIDS had finally reached parity with Amnesty International and the Rainforest, which was a welcome thing. The Coliseum benefit was the largest of several events around the Bay Area, all organized by Bill Graham Presents, and meant to raise awareness as well as money. Originally, the Oakland show was supposed to have joint headliners with both The Dead and Huey Lewis in the News, but a few weeks before the show, Huey Lewis had to drop out, and rather sheepishly later, his management publicly conceded that the stadium show was actually cutting into the ticket sales for shows that Lewis and the band were playing in Northern California, and they couldn't really afford to work for what was effectively nothing. Now, the Dead, of course, had no such concerns. At a press conference, Jerry was very gracious and said that Huey had to listen to his management. It was part of the business. Huey Lewis and the News were the biggest act in the Bay Area at the time with respect to record sales, and yet the Dead outdrew them by several multiples. The Dead were no longer an aging hippie band who hadn't broken up. They were the biggest draw in town. And actually, for a number of years, they were consistently shown to be the highest grossing tour for any road revenues for any given year because of the number of shows they played and the size of the crowds that they were drawing at that time. By 1989, the Dead were huger than ever thanks to Touch of Grey, as we said at the Outcast, giving a little nod to that as the opening tune today, but going with Althea because who wouldn't, which the Dead opened with, right? And so the Coliseum show was an opportunity for a lot of people who always wanted to see the Dead but hadn't been able to get tickets. The Frost and Shoreline show sold out pretty rapidly, so regular rock fans who wanted to see the Dead were out of luck. Thus, the crowd was very Dead positive, with plenty of Deadheads, but far less like the insular club of Deadhead veterans that were characteristic of Bay Area shows at the time. There were many fascinating aspects to this event, but in retrospect, the most fascinating was that former Creedence Clearwater Revival frontman John Fogerty was second on the billing, and it was known before the show that Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir would be part of his backing group. Think about that for a minute. Now, Creedence had been hugely and titanically popular, but Fogerty had had a bitter dispute with his record company since the mid-1970s, and as a result had refused to play any of his Creedence songs in concert to prevent the label from getting any money. By 1989, however, although his ire towards Fantasy Records had not subsided, for various reasons Fogerty had come to terms with his old songs, so it was widely known that not only would Garcia and Weir be backing Fogerty, but that they would be playing Creedence classics as well. Everything pointed towards an event of historic proportions. There is actually a YouTube video of the entire Fogerty set that I would encourage you to view. I've always been a big Creedence fan, love John Fogerty, love that, you know, he's a Bay Area guy who sounds like he's from Louisiana and, you know, plays like this and has such a good time with the boys. And in fact, you know, he had a very unique status in the Bay Area at the time. Everyone was reminded of that when word was unofficially leaked, I believe through Joel Selvin's Chronicle column at the time, that not only would Garcia and Weir back Fogerty, but that Fogerty would be playing his old songs. Now, John hit the stage late in the afternoon, last up before the Grateful Dead. His band previously announced was John Fogerty, lead guitar and vocals, Jerry Garcia on guitar, Bob Weir on guitar, Randy Jackson on bass, and Steve Jordan on drums. Jackson and Jordan were well-known and well-regarded as session players. Randy Jackson was a working member of Santana's band at the time, among many other gigs. Today, of course, Jackson is best known as a judge for the TV show American Idol, but that was far in his future back then. Jordan had played the Bay Area recently on the 1988 tour with Keith Richards, whose album he had co-produced. Fogerty wound up playing 11 songs in about 45 minutes. Born on the Bayou, Green River, Down on the Corner, Rock and Roll Girl, Center Field, which there's actually a singular video of them playing center field in center field of the Oakland A's stadium at the time. And you see Garcia, you know, in the screen with Fogerty, and it's kind of funny, right? Because Fogerty's out front and Garcia standing back there, but he's smiling and having a great time. They played Proud Mary, Midnight Special, Bad Moon Rising, Fortunate Son, and then two encores with Clarence coming out and playing the tenor sax for them, Susie Q and Long Tall Sally. The question most of us would like to have answered about the show is, who rehearsed, right? Because from watching the video, it is clear that John Fogerty had run through the songs with Randy Jackson and Steve Jordan. Now, Creedence songs are delightfully basic and as well as famous worldwide, so pros like Jackson and Jordan hardly needed many takes. On every song, however, Jackson and Jordan both provide a funky bottom and plenty of accent. They knew the tunes, and they knew how to make them swing, so I think they had worked on them with Fogerty, it sounds like. Garcia, on the other hand, was notorious for never wanting to rehearse. Weir is far less notorious for avoiding rehearsals, though it's also known that he is famously not on time, so it may amount to something similar. Since John Fogerty wasn't particularly close to any member of the Dead, it's clear that Bill Graham was the one who got Garcia and Weir to accompany Fogerty, and in doing so, make it an event in classic Graham style. Could Graham have persuaded Garcia to rehearse? Well, the alternative is strange, namely playing a show in front of 40,000 people with at least two band members completely flying blind, although I suppose if anybody could do it, right, at least at that time, you would say it would be Jerry and Bobby. So on the day of the show, the story is that Garcia and Weir had a dressing room run-through with Fogerty and the rhythm section agreeing on the tempo and the intros. Sandy Rothman has described how the Jerry Garcia acoustic band never really practiced their songs. They just agreed on an intro and tempo and sang choruses together. Now, granted, Rothman, Garcia, and Dave Nelson had played all those songs before, when Jerry was playing with the acoustic band, but it was usually 20. But that was usually 20 years ago. Still, one chorus run through was sufficient. So it seemed like Fogerty talked Garcia and Weir through the planned songs, but they had never really played together until they got on the stage. Creedence songs have a nice groove, but they aren't jamming platforms, so of course Garcia just kind of plunks away through the entire show. Maybe not his most memorable performance, but on the other hand, his health in 1989 was as good as it had been for at least a decade, and would probably never be quite that good again. Yet the stunning success of Touch of Grey, gratifying as it was, must have ensured the bubble of Garcia's life meant that he was now more insulated than ever. Garcia wasn't just a legend to Deadheads, he was in the pantheon now, the biggest rock star in the Bay Area, in a beautiful cage with no escape. When Fogerty kicks off the familiar booming riff of Born on the Bayou, Garcia is tucked back on the stage left next to Steve Jordan's drums. Randy Jackson is on the other side of Jordan, and Weir is right next to Jackson. Although Garcia plays a very simple figure behind Fogerty for Bayou, his eyes on Jordan and Jerry has a big happy grin on his face. If I'm not imagining this, Garcia has a big grin on his face throughout the entire set, and he mugs happily with Jordan as the drummer plays fills and accents throughout the set. Weir seems to be having the same kind of fun with Randy Jackson over on stage right. Fogerty is the star front and center, but the band is getting their own groove behind him. So let's jump right in and check out a little part of Down on the Corner with John Fogerty being backed by Jerry and Bobby at the Day on the Green, the AIDS benefit concert.
Guys, in case I get all carried away and flustered, because some people were very nice to let me be part of this. especially over here, Bobby Weir. Randy Jackson. Steve Jordan. The man. Wake him up. Jerry Garcia. You know, genius at work. Busy with all that stuff.
So that's John Fogerty introducing his band, throwing Jerry a little shit. We'll get to that in a minute. Down on the Corner is a song by Creedence Clearwater Revival. It appeared on their fourth studio album, Willie and the Poor Boys, from 1969. The song peaked at number three on the Billboard Hot 100 on December 20th, 1969. The flip side, Fortunate Son, reached number 14 on the U.S. charts on November 22nd, 1969, the week before Billboard changed its methodology on double-sided hits. Now, Fogerty said isn't necessarily a big deal to the Deadheads, but it's hard to get around the fact that Garcia really looks like he's having a great time. Whether Fogerty was bigger than Garcia is really beside the point. Fogerty is a genuine star with genuine hits, so he's the center of attention while he's on stage. For any singer less important than Fogerty, as in just about all of them, Garcia could not hang back, but he can do them. But he can do so here. So for 45 minutes, it's like Garcia is at the Keystone Berkeley or something, hanging out with his peers, playing the guitar parts that are dictated by the music. Simple though they may be, when they get to Down on the Corner, though, Jerry's practically jumping up and down. In a small but fascinating moment, he gets up to the mic to sing backing vocals. Now, granted, the whole English-speaking world knows that it goes Down on the Corner. Out here in the street, Willie and the Poor Boys are playing, Bring a Nickel, Tap Your Feet. But Jerry actually steps up to the song, up to sing. Over the years, Deadheads have seen and heard Garcia make a lot of guest appearances with various artists, yet how often did he sing the chorus of other people's hit songs? Just asking. After Down on the Corner, Fogerty introduces the band, as we just heard, and Garcia's back is turned. So when it's his turn, as he's tuning up, Garcia says, "Wake him up." And Garcia turns around on guitar, Jerry Garcia. Now, Garcia grins and he goes back to tuning, and Fogerty says, "Yeah, genius at work." Now, this is just musicians goofing around, albeit goofing around and stage in front of 40,000 people, but Garcia gets to be just another dude on stage, perhaps for one of the last times. A few months later, on August 2nd, 1989, he would share the stage with Carlos Santana and Ruben Blades, but that was for a TV special where he was a featured guest. At the Oakland Coliseum, he's just a hired guy playing a bunch of top 40 songs, and it, you know, that's really true. As Deadheads, we always wanted certain things from Jerry. You know, when Garcia didn't give us what we want, we grumbled, and thanks to the magic of tape and digital recording, we can collectively complain about it for decades. Good times, right? But we have to keep in mind that what we wanted isn't always what Jerry wanted to do. From Memorial Day Saturday, Garcia really wanted to be in a band, playing songs the way they were written, singing his parts when they came, grooving with the drummer, and letting the front man do the heavy lifting. Did it ever come around again that Jerry got to play simple, popular songs with the front man with enough gravitational pull so that it wasn't all about Jerry? In that sense, Garcia's role as John Fogerty's backing musician is a last look backwards for Garcia, a time when he could just be in a band, if for only 45 minutes. Or as I like to think of it, the Fogerty set was a big pregame jam session for Bobby and Jerry, who soon come back out with the Dead for their standard 3-plus-hour performance. However you look at it, the Fogerty set was a fun throwback for Deadheads and a chance to see Jerry and Bobby relaxing and playing with a legend. Now, we are going to break away from this wonderful show for a couple of minutes and touch on some music news. Rock and Roll All Night. Who doesn't know that song by Kiss, originally released on their 1975 album, Dressed to Kill. It was released as the A-side of their fifth single with the album track Getaway. The studio version of the song peaked at number 69 on Billboard's single chart, besting their band's previous charting single, Kissin' Time, which only peaked at number 89. A subsequent live version released as a single in October 1975 released reached number 12 in early 1976, the first of six top 20 songs for Kiss in the 1970s. Rock and Roll All Night became Kiss's signature song, served as the group's closing concert number in almost every concert since 1976. In 2008, it was named the 16th greatest hard rock song of all time by VH1. From the Kiss Alive album, Rock and Roll All Night was as good as it got for me and my buddies back in 6th and 7th grade. We thought that was just the greatest stuff ever, and we always had a lot of fun jamming on that. So thank you to Dan for pulling that out for us, as always, right on subject there. But we do have some interesting music things to talk about today, and I always like it when we do, because there's a lot going on in the music world. The first thing that I really want to talk about, and you know, for me, this is very unfortunate. I don't want to get over dramatic about this. Not unfortunate like in a life-changing way, but unfortunate in the sense that my buddies and I were all in Chicago last week, and on Thursday night we were all set to go see Neil Young at the Huntington Bay Pavilion on Northerly Island, this wonderful outdoor venue out where Migs Field used to be, the private airport that served the CEOs who would fly in and out of Chicago until, following 9/11, Richard Daley became concerned that maybe somebody would take off from that airport and attack the city, or maybe he just wanted the land where the airport was. But in the middle of the night, he sent out some bulldozers that carved out huge X's in the runway so no plane could take off or land. And the feds came in and complained, and he said, "Sorry, you're in Chicago. This is the way it goes." And within a couple of years, this lovely music pavilion is out there now. It faces back in towards the city, which is set behind the band, so you can, you know, on good nights, and you know, especially in the summer, you get a great view of the skyline while you're watching the show. Unless you're on the floor or very close up to the stage, in which case you should be looking at the stage and enjoying your great concert location. But for those of us that tend to sit back a little bit farther and maybe a few rows up in the stands, so we can see everything and have the seat for the occasional sit down when we need it these days. It's a very, very beautiful setting and really a lot of fun. So his concert was actually postponed this past Thursday, just hours before showtime. And the statement that came out on Northerly Island's VenueX page said the show, part of a tour with Young bands with his band Crazy Horse, was postponed due to illness. There were no details about who was ill. This show is to be, as they say in the business, rescheduled. Now, this is part of his Love Earth tour, which began April 24th in San Diego, and it's reuniting Young, who's 78 years old, with longtime sideman Billy Talbot on bass and Ralph Molina on drums. Willie Nelson's son Micah Nelson has been filling in on guitar for Nils Lofgren while he tours with Bruce Springsteen. Tour dates are scheduled through September, although now Willie's show that was scheduled really, I guess, for tonight, I believe, in Austin has been canceled, and a subsequent show coming up, and I want to say Dallas, has also been canceled, so we're not quite sure what's going on. The set lists have been a dream for fans of Neil, featuring a really strong, powerful electric sets with Cortez the Killer, Cinnamon Girl, Like a Hurricane, Powderfinger, Sedan Delivery, always a favorite of ours, and my good buddy Dan, Down by the River, Ohio, and other of Neil's electric ballads. But he's also playing a solo acoustic set with tunes including Comes a Time, Heart of Gold, I Am a Child, a little nod to his Buffalo Springfield days, and a C.S. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young hit, and Helpless. You know, we had some good friends in from out of town, some good friends in town, all ready to see the show. We were downtown at our buddy Harold's place, up on his rooftop of his building, enjoying this lovely scenery, getting ready for a quick bite, and then heading over to Northerly Island for the show. We had some great seats, thanks to our good buddy Kerry, who was able to secure them from us. Out-of-town visitors, good buddy Mike was in, our friend Suzanne made it. My wife was there, and we were all set, and all of a sudden our cell phones started going off right at the same time, and we were all getting the same messages being texted to us from the production company who was putting on the show, saying nothing more than show is terminated, canceled tonight due to illness, and nothing more. Now, even as the time of this taping, which is yesterday for you guys, there's been nothing more other than the fact that these next two shows have been canceled. Certainly hoping that it's not serious, regardless of who it is. But, you know, Neil Young, who's 78, is a national treasure. And though I certainly don't wish anybody else ill will, it would be a shame for Neil to be the one going through those conditions, especially if it meant we might lose the opportunity to see him. Of course, if that is the case, we will always be fans of Neil's and support him no matter what. But you really like to be able to see those shows if you can. So we came tantalizingly close. And while, you know, we'll have to see what the odds of it being rescheduled are, trying to get the whole group back together again that was going to go out there seems slim. But look, you never know. And we're going to hold out positive hope and positive thoughts for Neil and everybody in his band and the folks associated with his tour, and hope that everybody is good and healthy. And that it's not long before we get word of when we may have an opportunity to see this show. So that's something right away that you know, is really kind of a bummer, right? You're really all set to see a show. It gets canceled like that. Now, we actually went through that a couple of summers ago with Sacred Rose when it came to town. And the final day of music, which had a killer lineup of music that we were all out there to see and ready to go, wound up getting canceled because of a thunderstorm that never was. And I recognize, we talked about it at the time, that it's, you know, a concert promoter's job to keep the people safe and all of that, but we thought it was a little bit of overkill, and that anyone could tell from wherever they were that it really wasn't going to be a problem, but they didn't see it that way, and so that was kind of a bummer. I know that a few years back, I think I've talked about this on the show before, the time that my son and all of his, my son Matthew and all of his fish buddies had driven out to New York State to Watkins Glen to see the Fish Curveball Festival, which was canceled because of heavy rains and a problem of contaminated drinking water. And they found out literally as they were pulling into the parking lot out there. Now, I think we can all agree that having driven that considerable distance is far worse than us still sitting in my buddy's house, you know, enjoying fine food and a good bottle of wine and, you know, whatever else there was to enjoy that people like us like to enjoy before we go to concerts. And although it was very sudden and disappointing, and yes, our friends who had flown in from out of town, my good buddies Andy and Alex went from San Francisco, I said my good buddy Mikey, you know, we had each other's company, and that was always enjoyable. But nevertheless, that is what it is. Now, this plays into my next story, which is that this coming Saturday night, I'm going to be in Las Vegas Saturday, June 1st, to see Dead & Company at the Sphere, again, with a bunch of my good buddies, including my good buddy Mark from St. Louis. Andy and Alex will be there. My good buddy Mike will be there again with his girlfriend Lynn. And my buddy Eric will be there, also from San Francisco. Phil and Tammy from Minneapolis, just all sorts of great folks, and it's going to really be a lot of fun. Very, very excited to see Dead & Company. I've been checking their set list, and they've looked very, very strong. The people who have been there said that they're sounding really good, and of course, the Sphere is a story in and of itself, and just really excited to have a chance to be out there, check it all out, visit again with good buddies, and, you know, a summer of music kind of rolls on. So, yep. Although I miss getting to see Neil with them, we'll all be out there seeing Dead & Co. this Saturday night. And hopefully, due to Dan's perseverance and willingness to work at strange times and strange hours, I'm hoping to be able to tape next week's show after the Saturday night show, and maybe after I get a few hours of sleep and still have enough time before I run back to the airport to grab a flight back home. But we'll be very excited to tell everybody about it. And what's going on, because I'm sure it will be a fun time, and I really am very excited to get to see Dead & Co. again, and just as importantly, to have a chance to check out this really, really cool music venue that everybody is just raving about. One final music story I just want to note on it, there's a new compilation LP being released. It's called Grateful. The Music Plays the Band features 17 Grateful Dead covers. And members of the Grateful Dead community have put their talents together on a new compilation album from ALP dubbed Grateful. The Music Plays the Band. The 17-track collection hits many pillars of the band's catalog, from beloved originals to traditionals and customary covers. Set pulls in a range of material that is representative of the project's deference, paying homage to the Jam, veterans, or various talents from dead orbits, such as collaborators, admirers, and more. The album is now out in full. Tapping into the freewheeling Jam spirit of the original band, members of offshoot projects and solo work, the LP features known cover bands who have dedicated their craft to reinterpreting parts of the Grateful Dead songbook on the live stage, including the likes of Dark Star Orchestra, who performed Jack Straw and Morning Dew, Cubensis, Music Never Stopped, Unlimited Devotion, they play Mississippi Half Step Uptown Toodaloo, Brown Eyed Woman playing the song Sugaree, that is not Sugaree playing Brown Eyed Woman, it is Brown Eyed Woman playing Sugaree, Dead Humor. Bertha, Grateful Drag, One More Saturday Night they play, Afro Dead plays Dark Star, and Jerry's Middle Finger plays See What Love Can Do. So apart from the tribute acts, Jerry Garcia's new Riders of the Purple Sage bandmate David Nelson and his band take on Friend of the Devil. Elsewhere, Bob Weir's Dead and Company bandmate bassist O'Teal Burbridge reprises Stella Blue, a feature of his own covers LP, an homage to the shared songbook of Garcia and Robert Hunter, 2023's Lovely View of Heaven. Grateful the music plays, the band extends to feature Bay Area favorites, ALO, They Love Each Other, and six-headed synthwave Doom Flamingo with Touch of Grey, which seems to be a theme today. All proceeds gained through the net sales of the album will benefit the Grateful Guitarist Foundation, 501c3 nonprofit organization committed to obtaining top-of-the-line instruments for select players committed to carrying on the legacy of Jan band music. Notably, the foundation will host their second annual benefit concert at San Francisco's famed Great American Music Hall on May 13th with featured performances from Melvin Seals, John Cadillac, Barry Sless, Elliot Peck, as well as guitarists David Hidalgo of Los Lobos fame, Steve Berlin, and more. So please check that out. If you're interested, check out the compilation album. It sounds like it's going to be very strong, and it's all money for a good cause, so we're nothing if not all about that. Now I want to swing back our attention to our show from May 27th, 1989, 35 years ago today, if you're listening to this on Monday, May 27th, 2024. And as we dive back in, don't forget that playing along with Fogerty were a few different music legends, and one of them decides it's time to stroll out on stage with the Dead right in the middle of one of their most famous party numbers. Let's check it out.
You kick your wire. Talk about hater, hater, echo, echo, Chacamotino, Anane, Chacamotino, Anane. Talk about hater, 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 echo, echo, Anane, Chacamotino, Anane, Chacamotino, Anane.
Ico Ico, classic Dead cover of the Dixie Cups tune, joined by the one and only big man, Waylon on the sax. Clarence had played a few tunes during the Fogerty set, as we mentioned, and joined the boys for this one and a few others during the show. In 1989, Bruce Springsteen was as big as ever, and Clarence was a big part of that success, but he enjoyed playing in the improv style embraced by the Dead. Clarence first played with the Dead at their New Year's run on December 27th and December 31st, 1988 in Oakland, and soon after this, again on June 21st, 1989 at Shoreline Amphitheater. He also played a number of times with the Jerry Garcia Band, and it turns out that one of Clarence's final live performances was playing in a show with Phil and friends a few years back down in Florida. When the E Street Band went on hiatus at the end of the 80s, Clemens, who had by then moved to the Bay Area, did go in search of a little bit of work and new musical experiences. In 89, he toured with the first version of Ringo Starr's All-Star Band, cut an album with producer Narada Michael Walden, and not surprisingly, surprisingly, given his new home base, befriended members of the Dead. Now, starting in the early 1989, as we said, Clemens sat in with both the Dead and the Jerry Garcia Band at several shows. With the Dead, he joined in on songs like Estimated Profit and Eyes of the World and partook of the overall Dead vibe. Clarence was an old pal, a soulful bro, Bob, we are told Rolling Stone in 2011, right after Clemens' death from complications of a stroke. He was a good hang. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, he was living out here in Marin County. He was in moving on mode, and he and Jerry and I mixed it up a bit. We were dropping by clubs like Sweetwater and sitting in with various bands. Now, as Bobby goes on to say, the association wasn't just musical. Bobby says, Jerry and I were both single at the time, and Clarence suggested the three of us move in together and have a bachelor pad. We are recalled bemusedly. Jerry and I almost went for it. It would have been a lot of fun, but I don't think anyone would have survived. Jerry was in good shape, but we were doing a little bit of drinking back in those days. But nevertheless, it's great to hear Clarence joining in. And in fact, the very next tune they play is the very next one we're featuring. And again, you get a little bit of Clarence on it as the boys pay homage to Bob Dylan.
But he expected it to happen. Well, I knew he'd lost control when he built a fire on Main Street and he shot it full of holes.
Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again, also listed as Memphis Blues Again, is a song by American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan from his seventh studio album, Blonde on Blonde, which dropped in 1966. The song was written by Dylan and produced by Bob Johnson. It has 9 verses, each featuring a distinct set of characters and circumstances. All 20 takes of Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again were recorded in the early hours on February 17th, 1966 at Columbia Records A Studio in Nashville, Tennessee, with the last take selected for the album. This version also appears on Dylan's second compilation album, Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits Volume 2, from 1971. Dylan played the song live in concert 748 times from 1976 to 2010. A live version recorded in May 1976 was included on the live album from that tour, Hard Rain, 1976 release, and was also released as a single with Rita Mae as the B-side. The first live performance was at the University of West Florida, Pensacola on April 28, 1976 during the Rolling Thunder Review Tour. So a wonderful Dylan tune, and one that would quite often make its appearance a little bit later on in the first set, and would always be part of a revolving hit of Dylan songs that Bobby would play at that time, whether it was this one or Desolation Row or Queen Jane Approximately, Ballad of a Thin Man, Masterpiece. There were a few of them that Bobby interchanged off and on most nights that would usually come somewhere in the middle to the beginning of the second half of the first set, if you will. And Memphis Blues Again was always one of my favorites, still is one of my favorites. I first learned of it from my good buddy Mac back in the law school days, who loved Broke Down Palace and Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again. And once the Dead started playing both of them, he was a happy man. The song was played 70 times by the Dead. It was, as I said, part of Bobby's first set rotation. Queen Jane Approximately, Desolation Row, Masterpiece, Ballad of a Thin Man, although that was only played a few times. This song, Stuck Inside of Mobile, was first played by the band on March 17, 1988 at the Henry J. Kaiser Convention Center in Oakland, and it was last played by the band on April 2, 1995 at the Pyramid Arena in Memphis, Tennessee. So it kind of dropped out of the rotation a few months before the end, wasn't part of the final summer tour. But just a great, great tune, and we always used to joke that Bobby, on all nine of those verses, could nail every lyric, but then have him sing one of his songs, and he would be hopelessly lost on the lyrics, and, you know, it was a good joke, and we had a lot of fun with it. So, we are going to take some time now to head over to the other half of our existence, which is our marijuana news. Dan? Okay, so today is going to be a fun day from Dan. Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by The Platters is not about marijuana. The song was originally written by Jerome Kern and Otto Harbeck for the 1933 musical Roberta, and it became a hit when performed by The Platters in 1958. The lyrics of the song are metaphorical, using the imagery of smoke to describe the pain and confusion of lost love. The smoke in the song symbolizes the tears and emotion that clouds one's vision and judgment after heartbreak, and not marijuana smoke. And that is true and clever, but Dan forgot one thing, and that is that in the movie Smoke, Jerry Garcia actually plays The Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is the theme song from that movie. It's released as a single. Jerry sings it just like you would expect a guy like Jerry to sing it, very soulfully, very nice, very great. And we'll pull that one out and we'll play it in the future. But yes, we are featuring a song that doesn't include marijuana because we want to make sure that our listeners are well educated and know all about these kind of things. We're not afraid to show you the other side. It's all good. If Garcia's willing to go out there and do it, then by God, everyone is. So thank you for that, Dan. And let's dive into our marijuana stories here because, as I say, we do have a few that I really want to get to. The first one, and these both today come to us from our good friends over at Marijuana Moment. And as always, we thank them for their strong content involving stories about marijuana and cannabis and what's going on. And this is a positive one. Police groups are backing a bill to end federal marijuana prohibition in legal states and allow interstate commerce. This is right. You heard that right. It's police groups. Two major law enforcement organizations have endorsed a bipartisan bill to end federal marijuana enforcement in legal states. A cannabis group whose membership includes large tobacco and alcohol companies announced. The Peace Officers Research Association of California, PORAC, and the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, or cops, are both officially backing the Strengthening the 10th Amendment Through Entrusting States, or the States Act. This is the 2.0 version. We've talked about the 1.0 version in the past, which did not pass. The Coalition for Cannabis Policy Education and Regulation, CPAIR, announced the endorsements on Friday. Representative Dave Joyce, a Republican from Ohio and the prime sponsor of the state's 2.0 Act, thanks to Law Enforcement Association, stating that as a former prosecutor, I know firsthand that our law enforcement officers are already stretched thin, forcing these public servants to walk a discrepant line between state and federal policy, not only defies states' rights, but is an inefficient use of precious law enforcement resources. Most importantly, it does nothing to enhance public safety and in many cases works against it, he said. The state's 2.0 Act would address this confusing discrepancy and empower law enforcement in their efforts to enforce cannabis law and address the unique needs of the communities that they represent. The bill, which is also sponsored by Representatives Lori Chavez de Rima, a representative from a Republican from Oregon, Brian Mast, Republican from Florida, Earl Blumenauer, a Democrat from Oregon and a well-known leader in the fight for legal marijuana in the U.S. House, and Troy Carter, another Democrat, this one from Louisiana, would amend the Controlled Substances Act to undo federal criminalization of people acting in compliance with the state cannabis program, as well as those operated by Indian tribes. It would further authorize interstate marijuana commerce and calls for a current unspecified federal tax on cannabis sales to support regulations and enforcement. PORAC is pleased to support the state's 2.0 Act, which strikes a crucial balance between state autonomy and federal oversight and provides a framework that promotes effective law enforcement practices, Brian Marvel, president of PORAC, said in a press release. PORAC is pleased to support the state's 2.0 Act, which strikes a crucial balance between state autonomy and federal oversight and provides a framework that promotes effective law enforcement practices, Brian Marvel, president of PORAC, said in a press release. Aaron Schmaltz, president of ORCOP, said it is critical that the federal government is working with the states to ensure that laws and policy provide for the intended outcome. Law enforcement doesn't operate in a vacuum. We operate under the public policy conditions in each of our states, he said. The historic disconnect between federal cannabis law and individual states seeking to allow legal cannabis must be addressed. This bill does that effectively. We look forward to a positive impact that the state's 2.0 Act will have on promoting public safety and advancing responsible cannabis policies across the country. The state's 2.0 Act would also make it so that revenue from marijuana sales in regulated states markets shall not be subject to Section 280E of the IRS code, which currently prevents the industry from claiming federal tax deductions available to other traditional markets. The legalization stipulates that the Attorney General would have 180 days from enactment to finalize a rule amending the CSA to exempt states and tribes from federal marijuana prohibition. Local law enforcement groups know their officers need, and what's more, say at the state level in how cannabis is regulated. Former Representative Greg Walden from Oregon, who serves as the co-chair for CSPAR, said. Generally speaking, we have to like the fact that we're now getting law enforcement groups who are recognizing what all the rest of us have known for a long time, right? Which is that it's incongruous for marijuana to be legal on the state level and illegal on the federal level, especially when under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, state law, federal law is supreme. Federal law controls over state law. So even though the states can tell us, look, smoking marijuana, you're not breaking the law in our state, but they can't tell us that we're not breaking federal law. And that's why, even though we have the Cole Memorandum or had the Cole Memorandum, which Jeff Sessions tore up, but I think could say is still more or less effectively the controlling policy of U.S. Attorney General's office for both Democrat and Republican administrations, that they have no real intent or interest in going into the states and messing around. But as we've talked about, when it comes to financial matters and things like whether or not your mortgage company, if you own a building and you want to rent it out to a dispensary, you know, will your mortgage company allow you to do that? Or do they get caught up on the fact that, you know, there's federal banking regulations, which would also similarly be suspended or modified under the state's legislation? And that would be a good thing. And in fact, one might argue that it might be a better thing to keep it as a Schedule One and give everyone those benefits that way instead of giving to them by way of Schedule Three, which, as we've talked about, creates many more headaches. And at the end of the day, it's still illegal. And that's really the part here that we're talking about. All of this remains a game, and we have to do all of this pandering around because marijuana remains federally illegal because politicians, call it like it is, just don't have the cojones to say, I'm going to be the one who's going to recognize the stupidity of all of this, the hypocrisy that's involved here, and the huge lie that's been perpetrated on the American public by years by claiming that marijuana has no known health benefits, by trying to claim that it's addicting, by trying to claim that it has no scientific value of any kind like that. And we know all of this not to be true. We knew it back then when Richard Nixon created the Controlled Substances Act and insisted on marijuana being a Schedule One with heroin and LSD and drugs like that, and even a schedule ahead of Schedule Two drugs like cocaine. So, this is all very good, but how about if we all stop the whining when people want to even move it to Schedule 3 and just go back and tell the administration, hey, let's go ahead and make this, and let's deschedule this. We don't need to reschedule this. Let's deschedule this once and for all. Now we don't have to worry about this crazy relationship between federal law, which reigns supreme over state law, and state law, which tries to grant us a right that the federal law says we don't have. And if we could just do that, we wouldn't need any of this anymore. We wouldn't have to sit down. We wouldn't have to figure out how to strike this balance. Law enforcement wouldn't be confused. Investors wouldn't be confused. Banks could do their business. Everyone would know how to pay their taxes, and people in the cannabis industry wouldn't be expected to shoulder an unreasonable burden just because of stupid laws that are almost 30 years old and were designed, or 40 years old, and were designed specifically to address financial issues as they related to the cocaine industry in South Florida at the time, and were never considered to be part of the cannabis industry until the IRS pulled it out of their back pocket in the early 1990s. And folks like my former co-host and founder of this podcast, Jim Marty from Colorado, he and his colleagues played large roles in fighting those battles early on and establishing some boundaries and some limits expanding the scope of what could be deducted for their clients. And many of these cases went to tax court and had positive findings. And, you know, thank goodness for people like Jim and his colleagues who did fight these fights for us. You know, because if not, who knows where we would be right now financially with the sale of marijuana. So let's just make it federally legal, people, right? Let's just go in that direction once and for all, and let's just pretend like that's really the right thing to do, just because it really is the right thing to do. And I think that that's important for us to all see. And once you get the police on your side, politicians should have no real problem with taking that next step and really making the move that's necessary to be made here. Now, my second story, unfortunately, takes us strongly back in the opposite direction. And the stupidity of it all will not surprise you. The individual who's behind it will not surprise you. And the fact that we even have to talk about this nonsense will not surprise you. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas. Okay, we can all just go away now because we know that it is going to be something stupid and moronic, because Ted seems to specialize in that. And, you know, he may be the finest example of a guy who goes out of his way to try to prove that he doesn't embarrass himself, but constantly embarrasses himself. And I'm sorry, everybody's entitled to vote for whoever they want, and I'm not here to tell you not to vote for Ted Cruz, but I am here to tell you that I think that he's a goofball. And as you hear the rest of the story, I'm hoping that you will agree with me, at least for purposes of what his position is on legal cannabis. Now, he's criticized the Biden administration's planned move, as we just talked about, right? Planned move of cannabis to Schedule 3 of the Controlled Substances Act during comments last week at a Senate Commerce Subcommittee hearing, citing increases in vehicle injury and fatality rates that he attributed to the legalization of adult use marijuana, right? Delivering remarks to the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Surface Transportation, Maritime Freight, and Ports, Cruz brought up a number of transportation-related concerns before pivoting to marijuana legalization and federal rescheduling. Another notable issue is drugged driving, he said, reading from a prepared statement. A 2022 research paper found that from 2009 to 2019, legalization of recreational marijuana was associated with 6.5% increase in injury crash rates and 2.3% increase in fatal crash rates. And yet the Biden administration, rather than working to keep our families safe on the roadways, has instead decreed that it will reclassify marijuana from a Schedule 1 substance to Schedule 3, he continued. The American Trucking Association quickly followed this news with a letter highlighting that rescheduling marijuana without an explicit allowance for a test for its use would create confusion and result in serious safety impacts to safety-sensitive industries. This is a difficult thing to unpack because it's so dense and so stupid on so many levels, that the minute he brings up transportation-related concerns and then trying to pivot to marijuana legalization and federal rescheduling, right? So, first of all, he wants to move it. We'll get to Schedule 2 and Schedule 3. So he talks about drug driving. We've had this conversation so many times that my listeners, I hope, can make the argument before I make it. First of all, a paper from 2009 to 2019, legalization of recreational marijuana. Well, that's a problematic thing for Ted, right? Because the first legalization of marijuana didn't start until 2014, January 1, in Colorado and in the state of Washington. So the first 5 years that he's talking about aren't coming from recreational marijuana. Now, it's possible that they might be coming from medical marijuana, but he doesn't say that. So we already know that he doesn't even understand the evidence that he's throwing out to us, because he fails to make this very, very important distinction between medical cannabis that was legal and was available as early as 2009 in some states, but legal marijuana, adult use, that was sold for the first time in Colorado and Washington State on January 1, 2014. So, you know, there's that. Okay. Now he says that it was associated with a 6.5% increase in injury crash rates and 2.3% increase in fatal crash rates. But here's the thing. Presence versus impairment, right? Was it present? Sure. If you're looking to see during this period of time where people that were involved in accidents that had injuries associated with them and fatalities that associated them, were they more likely to test positive for THC? The answer is, of course they were. Yes, 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 1,000 times yes. Because with marijuana being legal in these states, right, there's nothing stopping somebody from smoking joints at home on a Saturday night. But if the following Thursday or Friday, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 25, 30 days away, they get involved in a crash, whether it's their fault or not, and they get tested, you're going to see THC in their blood. And that's what they're counting when they say this. That's why they say this. What they don't do is test for impairment. To test for impairment, you have to do a blood test and you have to check the metabolites. And you have to see whether they're hydroxy or whatever the other droxy is. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I'll think of it in a few minutes. Right? Because if it's hydroxy, then it's associated and it's still in the stage where it's creating an intoxication level. But once it changes over to the other type of droxy, whose name I'm again spacing on for a minute here, it's present, but it's no longer causing impairment. So all of these studies are based on presence. They're not based on impairment. Because when you base it on impairment, the very impressive numbers go away. And we've talked about this because nobody supports impaired driving. Nobody supports intoxicated driving of any kind. But we live in a society that has a pact with ourselves, right? Let's say on Saturday night, Friday night, Sunday night of holiday weekend, Monday night of holiday weekend, folks are going to go to parties. They're going to go to picnics. They're going to go to restaurants. They're going to go all over the place. And the one thing we know most of them are going to do is have a drink, maybe a beer, maybe a glass of alcohol, maybe something else. And they're going to get in their cars and they're going to drive home. And what people in the marijuana industry are saying is, if we replace that alcohol with marijuana so they still get the buzz they're looking for, but they don't get it drinking alcohol, they will be safer drivers than if they were drunk. Not safer drivers than if they were not impaired at all. But if we're talking about a situation where somebody is going to get impaired and probably on alcohol by default because it's the legal substance, then we need to make it so that people feel comfortable smoking marijuana in place of drinking alcohol, right? Or instead of having two drinks, have one drink and smoke a joint, or maybe not have any drinks and smoke a joint, or maybe not do anything, of course, whatever you want. But let's not kid ourselves, folks. No, but that's interesting. We talk about drinking, right? He says, but first, before we get to that craziness, he said, Cruz points out, the Biden administration, rather than to keep our families safe on the roadways, has decreed that it will reclassify marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, he continued. And then he talks about how, well, let's just stop right there. We'll get to the American Trucking Association in a minute. Shut up, Ted. That's the most stupid argument you've ever made in the history of the world. People are smoking marijuana, whether it's Schedule 1, Schedule 3, no matter what. So, again, it's not a question of keeping families safe. If you really want to keep families safe, Ted, what you would do is condemn drinking and encourage people, again, to use the safer alternative if they're going to go out, if they feel the need to become intoxicated one way or another over the holiday weekend or any time. If they're going to go out and do that. This has nothing to do with safety on the roadways because we've already discussed that the numbers that you're using are not based on the right statistics, and so they're intentionally misleading because either you should know it or you do know it, and either way, you look bad. As we've talked, and as we've really talked about, it's not even a question of that it should be a Schedule 3. It should be descheduled altogether. It shouldn't be a schedule, unless you're going to tell me that alcohol is going to be a schedule, and I don't think you are. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about your next statement, which is the American Trucking Association. What your statement here represents is that if it's moved to Schedule 3, for somehow, without an explicit allowance for a test for its use, would create confusion he's trying to suggest that the trucking companies are saying, and if they are, then they are really stupid too, that we don't want it to go to Schedule 3 because that's going to encourage people to smoke. And how are we going to test our truck drivers? What do you mean, how are you going to test? You're going to test them like you would for any other kind of substance. You test them. And if you have a policy that says you can't be intoxicated at all while you're driving for us, that's fine. If you have a policy that says you can have two or less beers but nothing more, but you can't have marijuana, then you're morons and you're idiots for all the reasons we've been discussing. And, you know, the truth is I just don't want to hear about it anymore, because then you're really not paying attention and you don't know what you're talking about. You know, and that's your problem. But, so that's the thing. The little louse of the hearing involved marijuana. Representative of the AAA testified that a small proportion of drivers appeared to have increased dangerous driving behavior during the past few years, including driving after recently consuming cannabis. AA Research said Jake Nelson, the group's traffic safety and research director, showed that while driving generally decreased during COVID pandemic, some people actually drove more and appear to be riskier than average. Nationally, drivers admit to engaging more regularly in behaviors like speeding, red light running, and driving within an hour of using cannabis, he said. Now, notice he didn't say that they were speeding because of cannabis or running red light because of cannabis, just that they were driving within an hour of using cannabis. This is the way these arguments typically work and where they try to bring them all together. Most alarming was 24% increase in self-reported drunk driving, but we don't want people to be drunk driving. Now, here's the part that really gets me about marijuana. Back in 2018, Cruz said, I think Colorado can decide one way, I think Texas can decide another, when saying that if Colorado wanted to legalize marijuana for its state, that was okay. It didn't mean that Texas had to do it. At the same time, and love this part, Cruz has been critical of recommended federal guidance on alcohol consumption. During an interview with Newsmax last year, the senator drank a beer on camera and said federal health officials can, quote, kiss my ass, close quote, if they decide to move forward with a plan to reduce recommended maximum consumption of alcohol to 2 drinks per week. What is it with liberals and wanting to control every damn aspect of your life, said Cruz, who just got done telling us why marijuana shouldn't be allowed to be smoked, right? Who supports government's ban on abortion, right? So he doesn't mind a little bit of government intrusion there, or trans-affirming healthcare. He doesn't mind the intrusion there. But if they want us to drink 2 beers a week, frankly, they can kick my ass. So here's what Ted is saying. He's okay with you using an intoxicant that is dangerous, that harms you, that can kill you, that causes more accidents, and makes you a dangerous driver, much more dangerous driver. And at the same time, he's saying he doesn't want you to use a substance that has known medical use, constantly new studies coming out, that has known safety guidelines, that has known everything, that is that over almost 70% of the population of the United States, adult population, thinks that it should be legal. And he's telling us, no, you can't do that, but nobody can tell me how many beers to drink. Thanks, Ted. You know, you're a moron, and I think that you just don't even realize it, you know, in terms of what you're saying. You know, Cruz laid into the Biden judicial nominees during a 2022 Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing, asserting that the judge had been a partisan advocate for causes including legalizing potent strains of marijuana. Again, you know, these are such scare tactics, right? We've talked about, what does a potent strain of marijuana mean? You know, it means that either, you know, you've made it a little bit stronger, which probably puts it in the 20 to 25% range, or you're dealing, you know, very possibly with a lab or other testing facility that is inflating numbers. I'm not saying that all labs or testing facilities are inflating numbers, and I'm not saying that the ones who sometimes come up with THC readings in the 30s are, but many are. And it's creating an expectation that marijuana is this, you know, ridiculously strong substance that's become so strong that it's not like your daddy's marijuana, and that, you know, people today won't be able to handle it. You know, but that's like the difference between, you know, going and seeing that this month they're selling a certain type of bourbon whiskey that's normally 95% proof. This one's coming out at 125 proof. Okay, so they're making it stronger. Why? Because there's people who want it to be stronger. It doesn't mean Everybody wants it to be stronger. So enough of all of this. It can be frustrating and it can be aggravating, but it's important for all of us to know and to understand, especially like when people like Ted Cruz open his mouth and speak without even understanding what he's saying, probably some gibberish put in front of him by a staffer who never did smoke marijuana because, he thought, I'm going to go off and I'm going to work for guys like Ted Cruz and they'll never be able to find my skeleton in my closet like that, to which I say it's your loss and the country's loss. Finally, on marijuana news, I just want to talk about the strains that I'm really enjoying at the moment. And there are a few of them. And I think that, knowing the good strains out there is certainly a very good thing. The first one is the E85 strain. And the E85 strain is a... exceptional. It's a hybrid weed made from a genetic cross between Super Lemon Cherry Gelato and Runtz. The strain is a rare and exotic creation that combines the best of both parents. E85 has a fruity and desert-like aroma and taste that are truly pleasing to the senses. It's an unknown percent THC, making this strain an ideal choice for experienced cannabis consumers. We know that E85 effects include happy, relaxed, and euphoric. Medical marijuana patients often choose E85 when dealing with symptoms associated with anxiety, stress, and pain. Bred by Grandiflora Genetics, E85 features flavors like sweet and fruity and citrus. The dominant terpene of the strain is unknown. The strain is a limited edition offering from Grandiflora Genetics, a brand that specializes in exotic and rare genetics. But they're not the only ones who are growing E85. There's a number of people growing E85. Full Moon Farms. We talked to one of its owners, Nick Erickson, a few weeks ago. During my travels through the California area, I've been lucky enough to be able to sample some of their E85. And I will tell you, it's some of the finest marijuana I've ever smoked. So I agree with the reviews of E85 that we were just reading, but I disagree that there's only one grower out there who could really come up with it. I think that the Full Moon Farm strain is exceptional, and those of you who live in California and have access, and by the way, if you don't know, you can go to Full Moon Farm's website, and there's numbers you can call to actually get delivery from Full Moon Farms. They have agents in most of the towns from the southern border of California all the way up through the Bay Area. And I would highly recommend it. It's great stuff. Seems to be very reasonably priced by my experience. And the results are absolutely tremendous. And I would really encourage you to go ahead and to do that. The other strain that I want to talk about today is Strawberry Shortcake, and Strawberry Shortcake has just been another what I think is exceptional strain that I have found that I enjoy very, very much. It is an indica marijuana strain made by crossing White Wookiee with the white. The strain provides euphoric effects that put your mind into a state of bliss. Strawberry Shortcake features a strong and hearty strawberry flavor that will have you craving more. The strain is ideal for nighttime use or during an evening when you have nothing of importance to do. Medical marijuana patients choose Strawberry Shortcake to help relieve symptoms associated with insomnia. And there are also very many cultivators who can get you strains of Strawberry Shortcake. It's grown in the Midwest. In Michigan, there's a couple. A lot of people on the West Coast are trying to grow it. And I also recommend that. As good as E85 is during the day, I find Strawberry Shortcake to be just that good in the evening. So those are my strain recommendations for this week. And of course, hopefully you'll follow up on them. And if you do, feel free to chime in and send us an email or anything like that. And we're always happy to respond to people who respond to us. So going back to our show, May 27th, 1989, Day on the Green, the AIDS benefit at Oakland Alameda County Baseball Stadium, sponsored by Bill Graham Presents. And we're going to go back to a tune that kind of quietly became one that I enjoyed, and I think a lot of other deadheads enjoyed. And I'm glad that it did, because it's a Brent tune. And this is as great a version of it as I've heard really anywhere. So let's listen to a little bit from Blow Away.
Real, real love, real love. Real love, 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 real love
Brent wrote the music for Blow Away. The lyrics are by John Barlow, although it certainly seems like there's a lot of Brent doing some free rapping during the song. And when you listen to it, and to Brent's closing rap rant from the version of Blow Away captured on Dozin' at the Nick, you have to acknowledge that whether the words were improvised or not, they come from the heart, and they really have a strong sense of immediacy and urgency to them. Blow Away, unfortunately, was only played 23 times in concert, first performed on June 20th, 1988 at Alpine Valley Music Theater in lovely East Troy, Wisconsin, a show that I was lucky enough to attend, and played for the last time on July 16th, 1990 at Rich Stadium in Orchard Park, or Buffalo, home to producer Dan Humiston in New York. And it's a song that died with Brent. Once he was gone, the Dead never picked it back up, and I think it was too much of a Brent song for them to perform or for anyone else to try and step in and do. But it really is a good song, and Brent really, when he's getting high energy with it like he does in this version, and the one on Dozin' at the Nick that they reference, you can really hear it, and Garcia really gets into it, and I really, really love it. So we're getting to the end of where we're at today with our show. We've really kind of run over. This is what happens when I have a little bit of extra time because I'm not working and I'm instead playing with my granddaughter and she goes to bed early, and so I've got time to do stuff. And we're going to close with Wharf Rat, which is not the closer from this night or really most nights, but it could have been a perfect closer, absolutely. I'm not here to talk so much about the song right now, although I certainly could, but I think with all these wonderful concerts, you know, coming up that I'm getting ready to go see, as I said, this coming Saturday night, I'll be at the Dead & Co. show at the Sphere. I was hoping to have just been at Neil Young. Got a big string of Fish shows coming up down the road. But, you know, one of the things that a lot of us take for granted as we go to these shows, and, you know, a big part of what we talk about and what we do centers around smoking weed or, you know, eating mushrooms or acid or whatever your particular fancy is at any given night and in any given situation. And, you know, we've all experienced that. Oh, man, I got in, but I didn't have any weed with me. What am I going to do? You know, I want to find some weed. I really want to get high for the show. Or, oh, what a bummer. What a great show. How much better it might have been if this was a night I, you know, had chosen to drop acid or whatever. Again, you know, whatever your situation is. Yet there are groups of people who go to these shows over and over and over again and who never play out these scenarios in their head in that way. And the biggest and the most famous of them is a group that call themselves Wharf Rats. And they're a group of concert goers who have chosen to live drug and alcohol free. They arose out of the environment around the rock group The Grateful Dead and their followers, the Deadheads, both of which were rooted in the drugs-embracing counterculture of the 1960s. Sure, we've talked about how what an important role acid and marijuana and a lot of other drugs have played with the Grateful Dead musicians and with their fans and with the local law enforcement communities and really everything like that. The folks in Wharf Rat have a purpose to support other concert goers who choose to live drug-free like themselves. They announced their presence with yellow balloons, signs, and the Wharf Rat information and the Wharf Rat's information table. At a set break during Grateful Dead and related concerts, they hold up self-help style meetings, but are not affiliated specifically with any 12-step organization and have no requirements for attendance at one of their meetings besides providing some helpful drug-free fellowship. Like Deadheads, members of Wharf Rats come from all walks of life, and by 1990, the Wharf Rats mailing list had more than 3,000 names. I wasn't able to find a specific number for where it stood after Jerry died or even where it stands today, because Wharf Rats still exist and they still show up at Dead & Co. shows and things like that. The Wharf Rats began during the early 1980s as a group of Deadheads under the name the Wharf Rat Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Wharf Rats originally came from a small group of Narcotics Anonymous members who went to a Grateful Dead concert in Philly and located each other by their yellow balloons with the NA symbol drawn in magic marker. However, due to operational differences, they soon split from Narcotics Anonymous and are not affiliated with them, Alcoholics Anonymous, or any other 12-step program, though many of the members of Wharf Rats are members of AA, NA, or other 12-step programs. The Wharf Rats see themselves as a group of friends sharing a common bond, providing support, information, and some traction in an otherwise slippery environment. The relationship between the Wharf Rats and more traditional such groups has been studied in the academic journal Deviant Behavior. While Wharf Rats originated at Grateful Dead concerts, they now have a presence at other concerts as well. Similar groups include the Fellowship for Fish, the Gateway for Widespread Panic, the Jellyfish for the String Cheese Incident, Much Obliged for Humphreys McGee, Happy Hour Heroes for Moe, the Digital Buddhas for the Disco Biscuits, the Hot Tea Party for Goose, and more. And ultimately, they're all based on Wharf Rats, which remains the best known. The name of this group comes from the 1971 Dead song, Wharf Rat, written by Garcia and Hunter, and appearing on Skull and Roses, which contains the self-told story of August West, a down-and-out dockside wino. It's a very, very powerful tune, and that's a very powerful story, and it really makes me happy to hear that deadheads who are looking for a drug-free existence and experience, and they should be just as entitled to their drug-free experiences as many of us feel we should be to smoke a little marijuana if we want to. And it shows, you know, it's not uncommon to find yourself next to somebody who identifies as a wharf rat. And you know, on more than one occasion, you know, we've kind of altered our smoking habits, although I will say that most of them kind of go forward with this, what I see to be, you know, very positive attitude and outlook, which is, look, I have to do what's right for me, but I'm not here to, you know, harsh anyone's mellow or, you know, tell you not to do something or not to smoke or whatever. And so I think it's a matter of respect flowing both ways, and that's just really, really a great thing. And you know, I'm so happy to see this. And we, you know, I think most of us probably know people who either overindulged or, you know, indulged to a point where they no longer felt comfortable and are looking for ways to be able to control those urges while at the same time continuing to enjoy in a part of their lifestyle that includes bands like the Grateful Dead and Fish and Widespread and Goose and Humphreys and String Cheese and any of the others that we want to talk about. And they understand that part of that means that they will be exposed to individuals who will be at that show doing the things that in the past maybe they enjoy doing or maybe they wish they still could do. You know, I give great compliments to these groups of individuals, you know, who have not just decided we're going to come to these events, but we're going to, you know, really make our presence known at these events so that we can help one another and we can help others who may not even know we exist and may come to one of these shows and become confused as to what's going on or what they could or couldn't do or shouldn't do, or, you know, how does one go to a Grateful Dead show if they're not high, as, you know, people have been known to say from time to time, whether joking or not. And I really have a tremendous amount of respect for the people who have the self-will to be able to first and foremost recognize that there's an issue that they need to deal with, that their friends and family would like them to deal with, and that second, that they have the internal strength and ability, oftentimes promoted and strengthened by associations such as Wharf Rats, to actually be able to take those steps and put themselves in a position where they're enjoying life a lot more, and those who love them are enjoying them a lot more, and that's just a wonderful thing. So very, very happy about that. Wharf Rat was played 399 times. It was first played on February 18th, 1971 at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, and was part of the Beautiful Jam as they segued from Wharf Rat, I believe, back into Dark Star. And we have the Beautiful Jam, and it's just absolutely beautiful. And you can find it in a number of different places, including the original Grateful Dead box set, one of a number of shows tapes that you can find on archive, or it's on the back of the 50th anniversary of either American Beauty or Working Man's. I can't remember which one, but if you play all the way through and you get to that point, the Dark Star and the transition, and you hear the Beautiful Jam, and when they played it for Phil Lesh 50 years later, they said he had tears in his eyes because of how beautiful it was and how much it meant to them. And so that's a great thing. It's a great tune. It's a great tune to go out on. To all of our listeners, thank you so much for listening today at the end of a Memorial Day weekend. I hope that it was fun and safe and that everybody got to do the things that they wanted to do and enjoyed family and friends in a safe and safe yet fun manner. I will be at Dead & Co. on Saturday night at the Sphere. Looking forward to it, and we'll be talking to you about it afterwards the following, so a week from today. Hopefully, when you listen in, you will have my report from the June 1st show at the Sphere. Until then, have a great week, everybody. Be safe. If you're in Las Vegas, enjoy yourselves and be safe out there. And as always, please enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thanks, everyone. Here's Warfret.
Live the life I should.